Okay, we begin here by the two dots on the bottom of Kufnun Ched Amud Bet. Gemara says, Amar lo Ben Azai. So Ben Azai addresses Rabbi Akiva in the Mishnah. Amar Rab Simlai, Ada Amra Ben Azai Talmid Chover, the Rabbi Akiva Avo. From this, we conclude that Ben Azai was not just the Talmud of Rabbi Akiva, but he's also viewed himself as a peer of Rabbi Akiva. The Kamale, because he speaks to him in the second person, which is, Ala Chalukim Anu Mitzterim, Ela Shabbata Lechalek Aleinu. So he's addressing Rabbi Akiva directly. That would not be appropriate if he was a Talmid, and he would have to address him in the third person. The fact that he addresses him in second person is already indicative of a relationship of peers. And so that's what the Gemara says over here. You see from this that Ben Azai was a Talmid Chover of Rabbi Akiva. I mean, we would have thought that Ben Azai, who was a Talmid of Rabbi Akiva, would have addressed him in the third person. The fact that he doesn't then elevates his status to that of a Talmid Chover. And Talmid Chover then gives him rights to argue on his Rebbe, might have implications in terms of halacha. And we know that Arba Nichnasu the Pardes, that he was amongst those that went in with Rabbi Akiva. So now the Gemara here begins a next section. The next section, beginning with Shalchu Mitam, all the way until on the Amud Bet, Bal Minim Rav Sheshet, both the Rashbam over here says it, and before the Bali Tosafot also bring it, and they both quote the Girsaot from the Beinu Hananel, that this Gemara does not belong over here. That the Gemara actually should have been before the Mishnah, two Mishnayot ago, which is Nafal Dabayt Alav. So if you look at the way end of Kuf Nun Zayin Amud Bet, and I mentioned this at the end of that shir, that the Bali Tosafot there and the Rashbam over here say that's where the Gemara belongs. This Gemara that we're about to read belongs on Kuf Nun Zayin Amud Bet at the end. So that's just as an aside, we're going to learn it because this is the way it's printed in the Gemara. But the Rashbam, the Bali Tosafot, and they quote a Girsa of the Rabbeinu Hanano, they had this Gemara over there. Shalchu Mitam, they sent from Eretz Yisrael, Ben Shalava B'Nichsei Aviv, a son who borrowed from his father's possessions, B'Chayei Aviv, in the lifetime of his father, Umeit, and then he dies, Bino, his son, Motzi Miyad Alu Kuchot, has a right to take it away from the Kuchot. So actually three generations over here. We'll call it the grandfather, the father, and the son. So the story is about the father. The father borrowed money against, or using as collateral, the grandfather's property. Then he passes away, the father passes away, his son, or the grandson, can come along and take it away from the lukuchot, those the buyers, or the people that he sold it to. And this is something that's very difficult to understand in monetary matters. Love, my muppet. What is the love taking from? And what does he have that he's pulling away? A love borrowed money. Why is he going and taking property all of a sudden? Vote. The kuchot, my vite. Why are there buyers over here? The case is completely non-understandable. So then, what's going on? Ella, iitmar, achiitmar. This is what you need to say. So yes, the case that we brought, even though we can explain all the words in the case, we just don't know what the case is. That's the problem. And the people in Eretz Yisrael are saying, this is the most difficult situation, or this is a very difficult psak in Dinei Mimonot. If we don't understand the case, it's very hard to understand what's difficult about the case, except for the fact that the case itself is difficult to understand. So now over here, you have the Gemara say, Elei itmar hachi itmar. But you must say it like this. This will depend on what you think is going on in the remainder of the Gemara. The Rashbam reads it in this manner, and he says that's because in each of these instances, they're trying to figure out what was the situation, the circumstance they sent from Eretz Yisrael, about which they said this phrase, Zohi kashe b'dinim b'monot. This is a very hard principle in monetary matters. The halacha with regard to this is not as logical as you would have thought. So the Rashbam says that each case, they're trying to figure out what they sent from Eretz Yisrael. So then when you say, Eli itmar hachi itmar means, not what we said before, this is what they sent. And then the Gemara will continue to do that. Not this, and then it'll try again. The Bali Tosafot disagree with that, and for that reason they think the Girsa here is incorrect, that the Girsa should not be this, it's towards the bottom of Kufnun Ted Amud Aleph. There the Bali Tosafot say, V'lo gar sinan, itmar hachi itmar. Sherei kol advarim alalu shalchu mitam. Because everything we're about to list over here, they were all sent from Eretz Yisrael. The Bali Tosafot view it as being that all of these memrot were sent from Eretz Yisrael, coming up, we saw one of them which was nonsensical, but the Gemara is going to go through each of them and say that they sent all these memrot from Eretz Yisrael to Bavel, and they also mentioned in that sequence of those Piskei Halacha that they sent, that one of those is one of the hardest dinim in Dinei Mimonot. So Tosafot says they're just searching to match that statement with which case. On the other hand, the Rishban says that each case, the Gemara is saying, oh, is this what they sent from Eretz Yisrael? Is this what they sent from Eretz Yisrael? Not all of them were sent. They're trying to figure out which one was sent from Eretz Yisrael that matches up with that statement, Zukasheh Dividini Mimonot. So the Girsa that we have follows the Girsa of the Rishban, but you can see here in the Masorah Shas, he already points out that based on the Balei Tosafot's reasoning that this Girsa would not be there. So now the Gemara tries to get to a case that is more plausible or understandable. Ben Bishamachar Bechnechsei Aviv, Bechaye Aviv. So again, we'll use the same individuals. We have a grandfather, we have a father, and we have a son. So for an example here, we'll have Yaakov, Reuven, and then Reuven's child, Chanoch. The Ben, Reuven, went ahead and sold forward his father's property. He is one of the inheritors, if not the sole inheritor of his father's property. So Reuven's going to inherit Yaakov. And before he inherits his father, he sells forward the property to buyers, umet. And then Reuven passes away before he ever comes into the Yerusha. Bino motzi miyad al-kuchot. The child being here, Reuven's child, Chanoch, has a right now to go take it away from the buyers. Bizoi kasha kasha bidei mimonot. And this is what's difficult in bidei mimonot. Because, v'leim rulei, the buyers can say to him, avuch mezaben va'at mepik. Your father sold the property, and you have a right to come and take it back. What right do you have to take it back? Because your rights to this property only came through your father. Yaakov's property passes to Reuven, and from Reuven it passes to Chanoch. So now Chanoch comes along and says, it's my property. I'm the inheritor. They said to him, well, how are you the inheritor? Well, Reuven's my father. So I get the property from Reuven's father, who got it from his father, Yaakov. So they said to him, well, if Reuven's your father, and you're getting the property through Reuven, that means that the property touched Reuven on the way to you. If that's the case, we purchased it from Reuven. It should be our property. Why do you have a right to come and take it away from us if Reuven sold it to us? That's the Zubkasheb Emunot, the right that this grandchild has to get the property, despite the fact that his father had sold the property forward. That's the difficult situation. The Gemara is going to challenge that in 1 second. The Rishbam explains this as the case is just as we did right now. Whereas the Balei Tosafot already perplexed by what is the exact case over here, why is there even a question? And that is because Reuven sold something he didn't own. Reuven sold his father's property, Yaakov's property. He doesn't own it. Yes, he might come into it in the future. He might have Yerusha in the future, but that still doesn't entitle him to sell Davar Shelo Balei Olam. It's an asset that he is yet to get, an asset in which he has no hold whatsoever. There's no sale to start with. So why are we even speaking about a sale over here if Reuven doesn't have such rights? And that's what the Tosfot ask here, the Tav, the Tema. Lama yuchal otzi melelchot, afilu man damar, damet makne, davar shelo balei olam, haynu kelo shelo meita ben b'chayav. Even if you believe you can sell an intangible asset or an asset that's in the future, that's only true when the son still alive, when the Yerusha comes into his possession. Ela shenat no lo damim kodem shemeita av, agav shenaf lo lo kishum goses. Tafilu Rabbi Meir, damar damet makne, davar shelo balei olam, lo hani midei liknot b'nechasim kishum goses. If he never comes into possession of the property and can pass them along, then there's no way he could sell them forward. So Tosfot says, what's the situation here? How did Reuven even sell these properties? If that's, he can't sell them, then why is there even a question here? Of course the grandchild could take the property because the sale was an invalid sale. So he says, Uperish Rabbeinu Yitzchak Rabbi Meir, the Rivam, the Rishbam's brother, Badaya Mecher Inu Mecher. You're right. The sale is an invalid sale. Elin Chazarat Ma'ot Ayri Hachi. Question is there an obligation on the grandson to return the money? Of course, if Reuven was still alive and he came into possession of the property, he'd have to refund the money to the buyers because he sold them something that he didn't own. The question now arises when Reuven passes away and now his son, Chanoch, comes and takes the property, does he have an obligation to return the money that the buyers gave? The buyers gave the money to Reuven. The issue or the monetary issues with their father. Are they under an obligation to repay that money or to give that money back? What the Gemara is suggesting, according to the Rivam, is that these grandchildren have no obligation to return the money to the buyers. And that's the question, or that's what is illogical over here, which is, why shouldn't they have to return the money? If the possession or the property is coming through their father, then, of course, they should have to return the money that their father got, because the property came there. You have two choices. Either you give them the property, or you refund them the money. But what we're saying is that they get to keep the property, and they don't have to refund the money. That's a zukasheh b'dinei mimonot. That's the difficulty over here. Why should it be that way? Because if they are getting the rights to the property through their father, then those same rights that come through the father also should obligate them to return the money to the kuchot. Because as the Rivam points out over here, that but you have to believe here that even though he's unsuccessful at selling the property, he can create a lien. A lien can exist even on something that doesn't exist in the world yet. So what you're saying here is that the Reuven, when he sold him the property, he couldn't sell it. The mecher, the transaction was invalid. But what he did create was a right of a lien from those buyers on the property if it reached Reuven. If the property ever came into Reuven's possession, they'd have a lien on that property. So now that's the question. They have a lien on that property. Even though they were unsuccessful at purchasing it, they have a lien on it. So now they demand their money back and say, if you don't give it back, we're going to exercise our lien and get our money back. The child says, I'm sorry, I inherited the land. It's mine, and you have no lien on this property. They say, Mimon of Shach. How could that be? If you inherited the property because your father, Reuven, got it from his father, Yaakov, then the property came through your father, and your father owned it. Our lien exists on that property, and you should have to return the money because of that lien. If you say that it didn't come through your father, Reuven, then how did you come into possession of the property? If you didn't come, how did you get it from your grandfather if it didn't come through your father? So, of course, you have to give us back the money. So Gemara says, what's the chiddush over here? My kushya. Dilma matzi amar. Maybe the grandchildren can say, Chanoch can say, Mikoach abu adaba katina. We're coming from our grandfather. We are direct inheritors of our grandfather. The way that the Rishbam phrases it is, b'nei banim, harihin kibanim. Grandchildren are considered like children, and therefore the Yerusha over here passes directly from Yaakov to Chanoch. It skips Reuven entirely. Reuven's in the kever, he's already out of the picture. So you would have thought when you pass Yerusha in the kever, it means Yaakov goes to Reuven and Reuven to the grandchild. That's not true. The way it works is it goes directly from the grandfather to the grandchildren. And again, the way the Rishbam phrases it, b'nei banim harihin kibanim, that becomes a little more difficult in the second half of the daf, where we'll see that it applies even not to grandchildren. That this idea of passing Yerusha through someone who's in the kever has application even when you're not talking about grandfather, father, and grandchild. That there is this ability to have a direct relationship with the person bequeathing the Yerusha. Because the pasuk says, Tachat avutecha iyu banecha, in place of your fathers will be your children. Tishitemo lisarim b'chol aretz, and there will be appointed princes in the whole land. So here the Gemara is learning out from Tachat avutecha iyu banecha, that in place of your fathers, so here it's Reuven, in place of your father Yaakov will be your children, meaning Chanoch. That means that there's a direct relationship between the grandfather and the grandchild. Or in essence, the property is passing directly from the grandfather to the grandchild. So that, the Gemara says, that could be very logical. Why it skipped over Reuven and why the buyers here have no claim whatsoever. So again, for the Rashbam, it means that they have no claim on the property whatsoever. According to the Rivam, it means that they have no rights to make a claim for the money. Their claims against Reuven. The children inherited the property from Yaakov. It never touched Reuven, the property, and therefore their lien is not valid. Their lien never came into existence because Reuven never got a hold of the property for their lien to be effective. And so the grandchildren said, we got it directly from our grandfather Yaakov. It has nothing to do with our father. You want to go get the money? Get it from our father, a property that belonged to our father. This never belonged to our father. On the other hand, the Reed brings down another possibility because he discusses over here whether what the Rivam is saying is really true. And he says, okay, near the Reed, the Elu Nechasim Ketav Av Livno Meyom Olachar Mita. That the reason that Reuven was able to sell this property over here is because his father granted him rights in the property from today until after I die. Which means that, we saw this earlier in the Masechta, that Gufa Me'ayom Uperot Achar Mita. That means that he gets principal rights today, but he only gets production rights or leasehold in the property after his father passes away. So the question then is, Shanino Le'el V'Perek Yesh Nochlim, there we saw it was a Machloket Rabbi Yochanan and Reish Lakish, whether Kinyin HaPerot, Kinyin HaGuf Dami or not. So what type of rights does he have it over here? V'svir Lehu L'shachol Mitam D'Hochak Rabbi Yochanan. And they hold like Rabbi Yochanan, D'Mar Le'el V'Perek Yesh Nochlim D'Lo Kana Lokeach, that when you sell it in that form, it doesn't work. V'kom Makom Zoi Kasher B'dini Memarot L'Mele Avuch Zavin. So that's how he sold it. He sold it based on that machloket between Rabbi Yochanan and Reish Lakish, is because he did have rights here. He had principal rights in the property. He just lacked rights to the payroll. So then he sold it, but the people from Eretz Yisrael paskened like Rabbi Yochanan, and they paskened like Rabbi Yochanan said that it's not a good sale. It's not a valid sale. Since it's not a valid sale, the children say, we take the property. It's our property. And then the buyers say, what are you talking about? He had principal ownership at the time that he sold to us. We should at least have rights to this property because it passed through your father. Or we should at least have rights to get our money back because definitely a lien existed because it went through the father. He had principal ownership. That should be enough. And the answer is no, because Rabbi Yochanan says, kinyan peirot is kinyan aguf domi, and therefore your kinyan peirot is sufficient to override the principal ownership of the individual. He doesn't have enough ownership here to sell it, and that's why it's an invalid sale. So that's how the Ri explains it. And then, again, buyers are saying, if the property passes from Yaakov to Reuven to you, if it touched Reuven, then that's what we bought. And we should have the rights to buy it because we bought something tangible. He had principal ownership to sell. And that should be a valid sale at that point in time. And that's the discussion of the Gemara. The Gemara's answer, again, is it skips over Reuven. So he never really comes into possession of it because he predeceased his father and the grandchildren are inheriting directly from the grandfather. So now the Gemara brings a different case, which is the following. Elei kasha hakasha. This is the difficult case. Ben Bechor, shemachar chelek bechora b'chaye aviv. You have the eldest child. Again, we'll use Reuven, who's the oldest child of Yaakov. He gets a double portion in his father's possessions. So he didn't sell the underlying portion. He sold his double portion, the extra portion that he will get. Umeit b'chaye aviv. And then he predeceased his father. So Reuven passes away. Yaakov's still alive. Beno, Chanoch, the child of Reuven, has a right. Motzim yad alukuchot. Can go take it back from the chukot. Zoi shekashe b'dinei monot. This is very difficult to understand. Avu ha-mezabin, iu mepik. So the same question we had before. The father sells it, and the child, meaning the grandchild now here comes and takes the property away. V'chitayim ha-ochanami. If you say, ain't ochanami, this is the same as the case before. Amar mikoach avu ha-daba katina. We're coming from our grandfather. We inherited directly from the grandfather. Im mikoach avu ha-daba katia, b'chelik b'chora ma-bintei. If they're inheriting directly from their grandfather, why are they getting a double portion? Because if it's coming directly, if it skips over their father, the only right to the double portion comes from their father. So unless they're exercising the right of their father, they're not entitled to the double portion. So that shows you that it must be coming through Reuven. It's not skipping over Reuven. Where it says, Zumai Kushya, why do you have to say that? Dilma Matsiyama Mikoach Avu Ha-Daba Katino. Yes, it's coming directly from the grandfather. Ubamakom Av Ka'imna. But we step into the shoes of our father. So this is a discussion we've had many times before, which is, as a Yoresh, as an inheritor, how do you inherit? Do you inherit because the person is, in some senses, gifting you the property? So therefore there's a change in ownership, in essence, which is that before it was owned by Reuven, now it's owned by his son, Chanoch. Or do we say there's actually no change in possession of the property? Because Chanoch becomes his father, Reuven. He steps into the shoes of his father. So we discussed that before with regards to Yerusha. Do you view Yerusha as being a lokeach, as if they're buyers or purchasers of property, there's a change in ownership? Or do we view it simply as, when we talk about the tefisa tabayit, when we speak about the estate, is it that the child steps into his father's shoes, in essence becomes the owner of the estate, just like his father was, and there was no change in ownership? It's the same ownership, just the son replaces the father. So that's what the Gemara is saying over here. It's the same thing. We are inheriting directly from Yaakov. Our rights derive from our father, Reuven, not because Reuven ever got possession of it, but because we became Reuven. We became our father. Now, that is as far as the rights of Yerusha are concerned. We don't become our father that we have to give back the property. We don't have to give the lekuchot or worry about the lekuchot. We didn't sell it. That was done by our father. But we step into our father's shoes as far as Yerusha is concerned, and therefore we get the double portion based on that gzeret ha-katuv. That we are like the Bechorim, and we entitled, like Benot Tzlafchad. We saw that earlier in the Mishnah. The Benot Tzlafchad got the property of their father, not only his base property, but all his chelik as the Bechor. Because Tzlafchad was the eldest child of Chefer, so they also got the double portion, because they stepped into their father's shoes as the Bechor. And that's not called Roi B'Mukzak, because as far as the property of Yaakov is concerned, it's all there. It's ready to be inherited. It's not something that's coming in the future. It's not on the come, which a Bechor doesn't get. It's there. It exists. And the only problem is that Reuven passed away. So now his children step into his shoes. So therefore, that can't be so difficult to understand because we came up with a logic to explain it. Now, of course, when we're saying here that it's difficult, we're not saying that it's impossible to understand. Obviously, we want to have an explanation for it. But something that's so logical, you wouldn't say that this is kasher b'dinim emonot. Both these last two cases, they seemed illogical, but then when we explained it, we could explain it in a way that's simple or easy to understand. You wouldn't say, oh, that's difficult. You'd say, okay, it makes a lot of sense the way this works. It may not be the first way you looked at it, but here we're looking for something, when you say kashir dinim memonot, we're looking for something that you could explain, but it's very difficult to understand it or to comprehend the logic associated with it. Elei kasha, akasha. But rather, this must be the case. He knew testimony, or he signed on a shtar prior to becoming a thief. And then he becomes a thief. Once he becomes a thief, can no longer testify about his handwriting, because a gazlan loses all ne'manut, because now we suspect him of stealing money or doing things for the purposes of money. So that makes his trustworthiness go out the door, because he will do the wrong thing for money. And somebody could convince him to lie. Someone could pay him off to do something. And so therefore he loses all believability. And it's gzeirat hakatuv. The pasuk says, "Al tashed yadcha im rasha liot eid chamas." You're not allowed to use a rasha or a gazlan to be a witness in a case. So here he signed on the document, and now he can't testify to his signature. Even though the signature was placed on the document prior to his becoming a gazlan and losing his nemanut, at this point he can't testify to the fact that it was his handwriting. Aval echirim meidim. On the other hand, third parties can come along and testify that this is his handwriting. Hashta iulo mehemen, achrine mehemne. How could it be that he's not believed about his own handwriting, whereas other parties are believed about his handwriting? That seems illogical. Why would we believe other people to say that's his handwriting? In the end, that means that we're believing his testimony with regards to that shtar. So now, if that's the case, how could there other people do this if he himself can't do it? Zoi kashib dinim emonot. Gemara says again, my kushya. It's not so illogical. Dilma kagon shugzak tav diado bebeitin. It's a case where his handwriting was established in Beitin. The Rishonim express it in different ways over here. You can see in the Rabbeinu Gershom. So here the Rabbeinu Gershom says, the suspicion we have over here, again, which is the simplest way to read the Gemara, is, iu gufe lo mehemin la'id al ktav yado etzmo. He himself can't testify to his own handwriting. V'achrine mehemne al ktav yado la'id. So why should they be believed about his handwriting? That's the way we read the Gemara. The other hand, the Rishbam reads the question in the following manner. Hello, Shem hu atzmo chatam bo ayom. Sheker, shrei gazlanu. How do you know that when he says, or the date on the shtar precedes his theft, how do you know that's true? If he's a gazlan, he could just as easily forge his signature, or not forge his, forge the date, or come up with a shtar mezuyaf. Why is it that he's believed? Even if you say that he's not believed, why are other people believed to say that this is his handwriting? Ein ochanami, it is his handwriting. But who says he wrote it when the date says on it before he became a gazlan? He could have written it today and predated the shtar. So that's the way that the Rishbam phrases the question. And then in the answer here, that is kagon shechuzak bebeitin, the Rebbeinu Gershom says the following. Yodim anu shezeh shtar chuzak beidim lifnei beitin. Do we know that this shtar already was verified in beitin? Shezeh chatimat shalponi, that this was his signature. Oh, sha'amru yodim anu shechatima zu kazu chuzukah lifnei beitim sheyo shalponi. Or this signature that was already verified by beitin, we know that it belongs to so-and-so. So here the witnesses are testifying to the fact that Beitin already gave a verification of the document. So that means the document obviously existed before the Gzela. And they're testifying to something that happened before the Gzela. But that should be fine, because they in essence are not testifying about his Ktav Yado. They're testifying to the existence of a verification of Beitin. So that verification of Beitin took place earlier. It took place at the time of the Shtar, the time when he was still believable as an aide. So the Beitin verified it, and all they're doing is saying, we have that verification, and we know about that verification. That's the way the Rebbeinu Gershom reads it. The Rishbam, on the other hand, reads it as this, that they're testifying about the henpek. They signed on the henpek in Beitin. They signed on the Beitin's verification, and they are verifying the henpek. By definition, when they verify the henpek, it will also verify his signature on the shtar. But as the Rishbam says, that happens passively. Shtara mikayma v'kayim emeila. That happens by itself or in a passive manner. They're not directly testifying about his signature on the shtar. They're testifying about the Beitin's verification. And if the Beitin's verification is upheld, then that by definition would also uphold the document. So therefore you're separating their testimony from the verification of his actual signature. They're doing it in an indirect passive manner, and that's why it would work over here. That's the Rashbam. And then the Baalei Tosafot give a third view over here. which is, they say, Perish Rabbeinu Shmuel, Shekatuv Bo Behenpek, that they wrote a henpek, and they're testifying that they signed the henpek, the verification patent. Any other the people in Beit Din could be just as gullible as anybody else. Meaning, why would they know whether he signed it earlier, or whether his signature was a forgery, or whether the shtar is a forgery? All Beit Din does is verify certain external facts about the document. They don't verify the content of the document. They verify that this was signed by the witnesses who claim to have signed it, and this is the date down upon which it was signed. Well, if this guy is a thief, and he can make this up, the Beit Din could be just as gullible and be caught in the same problem, which is that they test, yes, it's his signature, yes, it has the date on it, so they verify the document, it was signed by him. How do we know that that means it was actually signed on that date? Because the Beit Din can be in the same predicament as everybody else. The henpek, or the verification of Beit Din, is not about the content of the shtar, or the validity of the shtar. It's simply that the edim that signed on here did sign on here. That's all they're verifying. They don't even have to read the shtar. They don't even have to know what's written in it. All they're verifying is that the people who claim they were signatories to the shtar are the signatories. Beit Din already noted his handwriting prior to being gazlan. So here you cannot say that it was signed afterwards. So that's the problem. If the henpek is dated after the gzela, it gives you no more evidence to the fact that it was done before or not done before, because they're just testifying that it was signed. They don't know if it was signed falsely or if he lied about the date. It doesn't have any relevance to know whether it was before or after he was a gazlan. But if they witness the signatures before he ever became known as a gazlan, then already there's verification prior to becoming a gazlan, and that's what is meant over here. So again, this becomes a logical argument then. The reason that others are believed over here is not because that he can't testify of his own handwriting, but somebody else can. They're not testifying about his handwriting. They're, depending on who you speak about, according to the Rabbeinu Gershom, they're just saying that we have a henpek. According to the Rishbam, they signed on a henpek, and that's all they're verifying. And according to the Ri, they're actually saying that Beit Din witnessed the signature before the time of the Gzela. So one of those reasons makes it logical that they're believed over here, even though he's not believed about his own handwriting. But this is the case that's difficult. The case where he knew testimony before he became the son-in-law of this individual. Now he became his son-in-law. Who enu me'id aktav yado? He can no longer testify about his own handwriting because he's a relative to the party in the shtar. Aval achirim me'idim, others can testify about it. So now the Gemara's question again is, hulu me'emne achirim me'emne? If he's not believed, why are other parties believed? So he was a signatory to a shtar. Happened to be the shtar was his future father-in-law's shtar. So then when it comes to the testimony about his own handwriting, he can't testify anymore because he's now a relative to the owner of the shtar. When he signed it, he wasn't a relative, but now when he's testifying about his signature, he is a relative. But if third parties come and testify about it, what's the problem? When he signed it, he wasn't a problematic person. If they verify his signature, then it should be fine. So Gemara says, how could it be that someone is not believed about their own handwriting, but other parties can verify the handwriting? You're going to say here again, it's the same as the one before, the case before, which is that the verification is not coming through their testimony, but rather through a henpek, through Beit Din. They qualified this and said, even in an instance where Beit Din is not involved, or the verification is not coming through Beit Din. And I think, Yechiel, you're already intuiting this, which is, what's the question over here? Dilma gzeret amelechi. Maybe that is the gzeret akatuv. That he's not believed, and others are believed. Because it has nothing to do with lying. Because if you don't say that, when it comes to Moshe and Aaron, for their father-in-law, some question of whether the Girsah should be Chutnam, or should just be Moshe and Aaron. What, they're not believed? Moshe and Aaron are not believed? We're not trustworthy? Even when it comes to testifying about their fathers-in-law? Or even when it comes to testifying about each other, they're not believed? They're obviously believed. So then why can't they testify? Gzeret HaKatov, that Krovim are not allowed to testify. Gzeret HaMelech, Ushlo Yid, Al Ktav Yado, Lichotno. And that is the gzeir de ketuv, that you can't testify. Or in essence, the difference between a gazlan and a relative is the reason for the psul. By a gazlan, the reason for psul is his lack of nemanut, his lack of reliability, his lack of credibility, trustworthiness in this situation. That permeates everything. So therefore, when he's not believed because of his status. That's what's ruining it. He is now not trustworthy. That's what the response says. How do you know when he signed it now? He didn't just predate the shtar. He loses all credibility in these situations. Therefore, if he can't testify about himself, then obviously others can't testify about him. And that's why we have to go to the answer of chukzak bebeitin. Over here, what the Gemara is pointing out is a relative is deemed to be pasul, not because they're not believed. It's just because of their status as a familial relationship. And in this case, the familial relationship developed later. Certain familial relationships are developed through marriage. They're not blood relationships, they're marriage relationships. So therefore, there could be a point in time where they have no relationship, and a point in time where they do have a relationship. That means that once they cross over that line, all of a sudden they lose believability? No. They're still believable, they're still trustworthy, they still have credibility. Problem is that the Torah says you can't testify for a relative. Now, it might be that the Torah says don't testify for a relative because we do suspect collusion, or we do suspect person being biased in these situations, but that just means that the Torah prescribes this irrespective of that being the reason. Meaning the Torah just says relatives won't testify. So cases where they are believable, like Moshe and Aaron, is that an exception? No. The Torah says straight out, objectively, no relatives will testify for each other. But that doesn't mean that they're not credible as people, they're not trustworthy as people. And so therefore, what they said before was totally fine. And the reason he can't testify about his handwriting is because the Torah says, gzeir tekatuv, you can't testify about it. But that same gzeir tekatuv says someone else testifying will be just fine. Because he doesn't lack credibility, we don't worry about him lying or changing documents or doing all these things just to help out his father-in-law. And therefore his loss of credibility, his loss of believability here does not stem from something inherently wrong with him. It stems from their relationship. And therefore, if other people testify independently about his handwriting, they are believed. Because they don't have the problem of the gzeirat hakatuv. The gzeirat hakatuv just takes him out of the picture. It doesn't change his believability. So if he testified his own handwriting, technically we would believe him. It just says, the Torah says it doesn't work because relatives can't testify. So that means when other parties come and testify, we will believe them just like we might have believed him. Just the Torah says by him it doesn't work. By the others, it does work. Ella, the olam kedamrinan, miikaro. We're going back to the original case, which is Reuven that sold out the property that he was going to inherit from Yaakov. And then his child, Chanok, comes and takes the property if he predeceases his father and the lukuchot are out. So then, b'kakashalach. So there, the Gemara said, didn't we already establish the logic was that the grandchild inherits directly from the grandfather and skips over the father completely? And you quoted a pasuk. The pasuk was, tachar avotecha yuvanecha. Tahao v'brochotiv. That's not a normative statement in the pasuk. That's a bracha that has been given in the pasuk. What's the bracha? The Rishvam says the bracha is, Tzadikim yeshlem banim ubnei banim liyorsham. That tzadikim have children and grandchildren to inherit them. So that tzadikim see their grandchildren, they see generations that come forth from them. So that's the bracha that's being given. That's one possibility. The Balei Tosafot suggests over here, this is the bracha. Ha'bracha dichtid dashminon kra, shiizke tzadik the banim kemoto. That means that the tzaddik will have children like himself. That's what it means. Tachat avutecha yubanecha. Just like you come from a strong lineage, your children after you will also have that strong lineage. They will be similar to their fathers. They will be similar to those that bring them forth. That's the bracha. The Marshal of Iris says that the bracha is this. Tachat avutecha yubanecha. It doesn't say tachat avicha yubanecha. It says tachat avutecha, which is the deal that they're all making over here, that the avutecha does not refer to avicha, your spirit of your father. Avutecha can refer to the avot ha'am, which is that's how the Marsha reads it. That refers to Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. That your children will be similar to Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. And that's the bracha that's being said over here. And again, with the Balei Tosafot and the Rashbam, you can read the same thing. You could say the word avutecha already leans in favor of saying that it's a bracha, not normative. Because it doesn't say avicha, but avutecha in a broader sense, and in a plural sense. And the Rashbam says that that's why the latter part of the pasuk seems to support that. It says, Tishitemo l'sarim b'chol aretz. It happens to be the Gemara quoted it before, but it seems like in the Rashbam it wasn't quoted before, that they will be made princes in the land. So what does that have to do with the grandfather? It seems to be it has to do with the status of the grandchildren. And that's what he's saying here, that you will have grandchildren and you will have those that are of stature or similar stature to you. They will hold on to positions that you have. Those are the type of things that are associated with bracha. Those aren't normative halachic implications. And therefore, the pasuk's not a proof. Mar says, Umi matzida marriage be bracha ktiv. Avalinian dinalo. Can you really say that it's just a bracha and it has no normative implications? It won't work when it comes to normative issues. Va tnan. Don't we have the Mishnah that came before? This is why this Gemara belongs to Mishnayot ago. Because here we're quoting the Mishnah from two Mishnayot before. And that's why when we began the Shir, we said it belonged over there. We've since had two more Mishnayot that have nothing to do with this. And that's why they believe the Gemara should have come after the first of these three Mishnayot and not after the three Mishnayot. Now follow by it, Alav Valaviv. The house collapses on him and his father. Alav Valmorishav. On him and his bequeathers. Vaitalav Ktubatishav Valchov. And the individual has outstanding claimants against him, whether it's a wife who's claiming her ktubah, or there are creditors going after him. Yosheav Omrim Aben Meit Rishon. The inheritors of the father say that the son passed away first. Vachakach Meit Av, and then only subsequently did the father pass away. Balchov Omer, and the creditors say, Av Meit Rishon, the father passed away first. Vachakach Meit Aben. And then afterwards, the son passed away. So again, the case, we've explained it before, is a case of Yaakov and Reuven, who are found in a house, and the house collapses on them. Who passed away first has implications over here. If Yaakov passed away first, then Reuven inherited him, and then after Reuven dies, his inheritors take it from him. But that means it went to Reuven first, and the creditors have a claim on the property, because Reuven came into possession of the property, and therefore the creditors can take possession of that property, or they can get their outstanding debts repaid. Creditors of Reuven then have a claim. The other hand, if it went the other way around, that Reuven died first, then Reuven never came into possession of the property. And then when Yaakov passed away, Reuven already passed away. If that's the case, then it never came into the possession of Reuven. And the creditors have no rights to this property. So now you can see how this is setting up to be exactly like our case. Because who exactly is inheriting Yaakov? We said over here, they're the inheritors of the father. And who are the inheritors here that we are speaking of? Those inheritors are coming to make a claim, likely are the grandchildren. It's Chanoch who's going to make a claim. Chanoch says, listen, my father passed away first, and then my grandfather. Therefore, you creditors have no rights over here. And the creditors say, no, 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 what are you talking about? First, Yaakov passed away, your grandfather passed away, then your father passed away, and he came into possession of the property, and we get it. But, wait, why do the children have any claim over here? The grandchildren are coming in and saying, listen, my father passed away first, then my grandfather. How did they get the property? They're only getting it because they got it directly from their grandfather Yaakov skipping over Reuven. That shows or demonstrates exactly what we're saying is not true anymore. We said, oh, no, it's not true, or this is illogical. What do you mean? The Mishnah says that it passes directly from Yaakov to Chanoch and skips over Reuven. That's exactly what's happening in this Mishnah. That's how the Gemara says over here. How can you say this halacha is not logical when it's exactly what's in the Mishnah? Which is, my love, Yoshea Av, who are the inheritors of the father over here? Bunei, the children. So the Yoshea Av, the inheritors of the father, are the children. Meaning that these are Reuven's children, who are inheriting the father Yaakov, Morishav. Who are the bequeathers over here? Achei, the brothers of Reuven. So in the case of the brothers of Reuven, you have his brothers are passing away, and then those brothers are passing property to the grandchildren of Yaakov. It's a case where Reuven and Shimon were together in the house, and the house fell down on them. So now the creditors say, yeah. Shimon passed away first, then right. Reuven. So right. Shimon's property came to Reuven, right. And then we are entitled to it. Children of Reuven say, no, our father passed away first, then our uncle. And then we're getting it directly from our uncle. Wait, how do they get it directly from the uncle unless it passed through their father? So the answer is that you can skip over. Whoever is in the kever, it skips over and comes directly to them. This is what I said before, that when Rashbam said, B'nei Banim Arika B'manim, you can't say that over here, because here they're saying it's coming through an uncle, and it's still coming directly to them. So even though it's coming from Shimon, it's coming directly to them, and their father's out of the picture. But what you see from that Mishnah is that we skip over the person in the kever. So you're telling me it's not a logical halacha, it's exactly what the Mishnah says. The Isaac Adatcha lo matzi amar mikoach avua de abba katina. If you want to say the grandchildren don't have a right to say we're getting directly from our grandfather, because that's just a bracha, not normative implications, kimeita ben, vachaka meita av, my hobby. Why would it make a difference which way they passed away? Either way, it's coming through your father. Because then, if you believe that it always passes through Reuven, no matter who dies first, then by definition, the creditors always have rights over here. So you have to say that the Mishnah believes that it's coming directly from the grandfather to the grandchildren. Otherwise, there's no difference in the order of their death. Doesn't matter if Reuven died first or Yaakov died first. Doesn't matter if Reuven died first or Shimon died first. It always comes through Reuven. And then there's no nafkamina. So what's the Mishnah showing you? There is a nafkamina. If there is a nafkamina, it means that the grandchildren are inheriting directly from their grandfather and they're passing over their father. Gemara says, no. Yoshea Av, the inheritors of the father are Echav, his brothers. Morishav, Acheidu Avua. And the great bequeathers of property over here are the uncles of the deceased. So in this case, you have Reuven passing away with his father Yaakov. The claimant is not Reuven's children or Yaakov's grandchildren, but rather Reuven's brothers. So Reuven's brothers are now coming to make a claim. Shimon and Levi, the creditors say Yaakov passed away first, and therefore all of you brothers inherited it equally, and Reuven got his portion. We're coming after Reuven's portion because he owes us money. The brothers, Shimon and Levi, say, no, what are you speaking about? That's not true at all. Reuven died first, and then Yaakov. So then when Reuven died first, the property remains with Yaakov. Now, Shimon and Levi are direct inheritors of Yaakov. So when Reuven passed away first, then all the property that's left with Yaakov belongs to them, because Reuven's out of the picture. So in that case, you can come up with a scenario in which the inheritors of Reuven actually are also direct inheritors of Yaakov. And that way they could skip over Reuven without giving you any implications. Doesn't mean that you skip over Reuven, because over here the rights that Shimon and Levi have is not through Reuven. They're getting it directly from their father, Yaakov, because Reuven's out of the picture. So it went from being three brothers splitting the property to two brothers splitting the property. Yaakov's possessions now belong to two parties instead of three parties. It's not that they're getting their possession through Reuven and it's coming to them. No. Reuven died, he's out of the picture. Reuven doesn't exist anymore. So therefore Yaakov only has two children to bequeath to, and that's how it's happening. Or the case of Morishav is a case where it's the grandfather's brothers. Meaning that Reuven and Esav are together in the house and it collapses on them. So now the creditors say Esav passed away first, and then Reuven. So now the property came to Reuven and we have a claim against that property and we can take it. The inheritors of Reuven say, that's not true. Reuven died first and then Esav died. And then the claimants here are the brothers of Esav and the creditors against Reuven. So the brothers of Esav say Reuven died first and then Esav died. If that's the case, then Reuven's out of the picture completely. And then Esav's property will be distributed amongst the brothers. Now the brothers include Yaakov, but Reuven died and Reuven has no children. So now Yaakov's claim that would have gone to Reuven disappears because there's nobody there to inherit on that side. So now everything will go to the brothers of Esav. On the other hand, if Reuven died second, then what ends up happening is that when Esav dies, the property is distributed amongst all of Esav's brothers, including Yaakov, who's already died. But Reuven was his inheritor. So Reuven steps into his father's shoes, Yaakov, and would inherit Esav, and that means that he came into possession of the property and the creditors have a claim. Then when Reuven died, all the property then goes back to the brothers of Esav because they're the only surviving relatives that Reuven has. So that'll make the difference. But in that case, you're not speaking about a case where you're skipping over anybody to give the Yerusha. Esav's brothers all are direct inheritors of him. Just a question of the distribution of the inheritance. Is the distribution going just to them? Or is it also going to Yaakov or his son Reuven? That's the question over here. And in the case of Shimon and Levi, Reuven's brothers, the question is it getting split between the three brothers and then Shimon and Levi are getting it? Or is Reuven out of the picture and they're getting it directly from Yaakov? But they are direct inheritors of Yaakov. So you're not skipping over Reuven in any of these cases, and therefore it's no longer a proof to Tachar Abutecha Yubanecha. It's not a normative halacha, because the Mishnah could be set up in a case where it's not skipping over Reuven or skipping over a generation. And that's the halacha that was difficult, which is, despite the fact that these individuals are getting their rights through their father, even so, they make a claim that it's coming directly from their grandfather, and it skips over their father, even though that's where their rights come from, the father, and the creditors or the buyers here are out of luck. And the Rishbam concludes over here that, first of all, the halacha is like all of these things that were sent from Eretz Yisrael. And the reason this one's considered to be kasher is that we don't find any explicit evidence in a Mishnah or in the Gemara to the din that is brought over here. But again, not that it's not logical, or not we can't explain the logic to it, it's just we don't find that logic anywhere else, and therefore it's considered to be kasher b'dinei mimonot. It's a difficult case b'dinei mimonot. And now this is the end of this parenthetical piece of the Gemara that all belonged to the Mishnah before. Now we're back to our case over here. The truth is the remainder of the Gemaras here are not directly related to our Gemara, but as a corollary or a correlation basis, they belong over here because they mention our topics or the topics that we've discussed. By me name Rav Sheshit. Ben Maush Yeresh Etimo Bekever. Does a son inherit his mother when he's already passed away? In order to grant those property rights to his brothers through the father. This question, this Gemara is back from earlier in the Masechta, back in Yeshul Chaim, where we spent a lot of time on this and discussed it. It's brought in here because of its quasi-correlation with the Gemara over here. So here, his mother inherited property, and his mother's property has to go somewhere. Now, there are two possibilities. Either it goes to her child, she has a son, or it goes to her father or the father's family, depending on who's alive. So now, if she has a child, the child takes precedence. He's the first inheritor of his mother. But something happened over here where he predeceased his mother. So now that he predeceased his mother, does he still have rights of inheritance or first rights of inheritance? Anywhere else in Yerusha, the rules are that you do have a first right of inheritance, even in the kever, even when you're dead. And that's what we said before. Reuben's son Chanoch has a claim on Yaakov's property, even when Reuben has passed away. The Gemara is asking over here, is that true by a mother as well? When we have Yaakov married to Rachel and Leah, Rachel is property from her father, Lavan, and she has a son, Yosef. Yosef would be the primary inheritor from his mother. The problem is that Yosef passed away. Now, Rachel passes away. And Yosef's brothers, Reuben, Shimon, Levi, who are brothers through a common father, but not through a common mother, their mother is Leah, so they don't have any relationship to Rachel. So now, do they have access to the property of Rachel through their brother Yosef? They would inherit their brother Yosef, but Yosef has passed away. So the question is, now that Yosef has passed away, is there a passage of the Yerusha from Rachel to Yosef, to Reuben, Shimon, and Levi? Yosef, anything he owns would be shared by all his brothers through a common father. Any brother that he has through a common father would be an inheritor of Yosef. Now, Yosef is an inheritor of his mother, but he already passed away. So does he give that right in the kever? That's the question. Amar lo Rav Sheshit Tanitua. We have an explicit Tanaic work that explains it. Av Shenishba, a father was taken to captivity. Umeit beno b'midina. And his son passes away locally. Uben Shenishba, or the other way around. The son was taken into captivity. Umeit aviv b'midina. And his father passes away locally. So now, in the end, our assumption is that both of them passed away. The problem is we don't know the order in which they passed away. Because one of them was taken into captivity, one died locally. So we know when the one who died locally died. We don't know when the one who was in captivity died. We know that they're both dead now. So therefore, Yosheav, Yosheav ben Yachloku. The inheritors of the father and the inheritors of the son will split it. Because there's no way to determine who passed away first. So they have equal claims over here. Where it says, Echidami. What exactly is this scenario here? What's the case? Ilema kediktoni. If you say, like it's written in the Braita, Hei Neu Yosheav, Hei Neu Yosheav Ben. What's the difference between the inheritors of the father and the inheritors of the child? Because, in essence, the grandchildren are inheritors of both. If you have Yaakov, Reuven, and then Chanoch, Chanoch is an inheritor of his father, he's also an inheritor of his grandfather. So the Yosheav and the Yosheav Ben are the same person. So why would you have Yosheav versus the Yosheav Ben? Yosheav and the Yosheav Ben over here are same parties. It must be that this is what is being spoken about here. Av Shenishba, the father was taken into captivity. Umeit ben bito b'midina. And then his grandchild passed away locally. Oh, ben Shenishba, or a child that was taken into captivity. Umeit avi imo. And then his grandfather, his maternal grandfather, passed away b'midina locally. And we don't know which one of them passed away first. Yosheav v'Yoshei haben yochloku. The Yosheav, which are from the mother's family, they are one party. Yosheav ben are the son's relatives, which are his brothers through a common father. Yochloku, they split it. V'imita, if you're right, ni'inami de ben mate b'resha, v'yarte la'avua di'imei. If you believe that a son in the kever has a right to pass the Yerusha of his mother, then he should be able to pass it irrespective of whether he passed away first, whether he predeceased his mother, or he survived his mother. Then that means that the brothers, his half-brothers, through a common father, are by definition going to inherit it either way. Whether he predeceased his mother, or whether he survived his mother, in either case, the Yerusha would pass to them, and then why are you saying Yachloku? they are the primary inheritors. Elav Shmamina, from this you would conclude, in a ben yereshitimo bekever lanchil achim me'av, that the son does not have an ability to inherit his mother, to pass it to his half-brothers through the father, and that's why there's a safek over here, because if he survived his mother, then his brothers have a right to the property. He inherited the property, and then his brothers with the common father will have rights to that property as well. If, on the other hand, he predeceased his mother, then the property won't come to him, because he's in the kever. And since he's in the kever, we say it doesn't work, he can't inherit his mother in the kever. And that means that his mother's property never came to him, and therefore his brothers, his half-brothers, have no rights to it. And the property will go back to the mother's family. And that's why it says over here, chokim, they split it between them, because that uncertainty will not be resolved. And therefore it's a mamona mutala safek, which has no ability to be determined, and then we split it between the parties. Not only is that a braita that you brought, but it's also a mishnah, our mishnah. Now, followed by talav valimo, a house collapses on him and his mother. Elu beelu modim shiach loko. Both Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel over here agree that you split it. Vimita, again, if you think a son can inherit his mother, even if he predeceases her, he now be the ben mate bereisha. Even if the son dies first, l'artelei may be kibrei. He should inherit his mother in the grave. L'artelinu lachei ma'avua, and then it should go to his brothers through the common father. And so, why should it be yachloku in our mishnah? Our mishnah says yachloku means that there's a scenario where it doesn't come to the child. What's that scenario? When he predeceases his mother. So then you have a proof from our mishnah, and that's why this gemara is brought over here. Again, it belongs in Yishno Chleim, but it's brought over here because they bring a proof to the evidence to the fact that his son does not inherit his mother in the kever from the conclusion that Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel both say achloku in our mishnah, which indicates that there's a scenario in which the child will not inherit his mother, and that's where he predeceases his mother. The Bali Tosafot asks over here, wait a minute, why did Rav Sheshet bring as a proof a braita when it's an explicit mishnah, our mishnah? Why would you ever bring a braita as a proof versus bringing a mishnah as a proof? A mishnah everybody knows about, and a mishnah carries more weight. So why did he do that, and then only afterwards does Rav Acha bar Nyume bring our mishnah? So the Bali Tosafot say that Vomer Rabbi Mishom Dach Braita Mishabeshti Evia Vayeru Tzelitarza. Rav Sheshet brought the braita because he got a double benefit from it. First of all, he got a halacha, but and more importantly, he was able to explain the braita. We had a braita that was inexplicable before, and now he was able to fix the braita so that it is understandable. So that's why Rav Sheshet brought that braita, is because he got the benefit, or the added benefit of explaining the braita. Ein Hachanami could have brought the mishnah, but he brought the mishnah, he'd only have his proof without getting the benefit of explaining the braita. Here he can explain the braita, plus he can bring his proof down. Now Gemara says, Elav Shmamina, from this you would conclude, Ein ben yereshit imo bekever l'anchil achim menav, that the son does not inherit his mother in the kever to get those properties to his brothers, to a common father. Shmamina, and that is the conclusion. The time of mind, Gemara says, okay, now we know that's the halacha, what's the reasoning behind that halacha? Amrabaye nemra siba beben, benemra siba bebal. We spoke about this prior in Yishno Chleim, about the fact that property moves from Shevet to Shevet in two ways. One is to a husband. When a husband inherits his wife, the property moves from the Shevet of his wife to his Shevet. It also moves to a child. If a mother is in possession of property from her father, and then her child inherits her, her child will be miyuchas after the father's Shevet. So again there's a havarat nachala, or hasavat nachala is the way that the pasuk speaks about it, or restricts. But the case of Benot Slavchad, of moving property from Shevet to Shevet, that's the verb that they use. And so the Gemara says that there's a hekesh between the movement of property from a mother to a son, and that from a wife to a husband. Masiba amur bebal in a bayurishit ishto bekever. Just like in the case of a husband does not inherit his wife bekever. Afsiba amurab ben, so too, the movement of property that is said by the son, in a ben yurishit imo bekever. His son does not inherit his mother in the grave. In order to grant that ownership to his brothers through a common father to his half-brothers. So actually this is a Gemara that we saw earlier in the Masechta. And earlier in the Masechta, the Rashbam and the Bali Tosafot argue about the explanation of this Gemara. The Rashbam himself notes the problem with his explanation over here, which is why the Bali Tosafot back there said that they thought the Rashbam was wrong. The way that the Rashbam reads it is, the husband does not inherit his wife in the kever when she passed away. When she predeceases him, he does not inherit her property. So for instance, if his father-in-law is still alive, and then his wife passes away, then his father-in-law passes away, and his wife is the only inheritor. At that point, the husband does not inherit his wife or the father-in-law's property, because his wife is already in the kever. So just like when his wife's in the kever, he does not inherit, so too, the brothers do not inherit their half-brother's mother, or the son does not bequeath property to his brothers from his mother when he's already in the kever. As the Rashbam points out over here, Hai bekever lo dami lahu kever debal. Who's in the grave here is different. Because in the case of the husband and the wife, the way the Rashbam is explaining it, the bequeather is in the kever. The wife, who's the one giving the property to the husband, is the one in the kever. In our instance, it's the son who's in the kever. It's the recipient, it's the oresh who's in the kever, because he predeceased his mother. So the meaning of kever in the two cases is different. But despite that fact, the Rashbam explains the Gemara that way. By Tosafot, because of that, explain that the kever over here is not the wife being in the kever, but rather the Baal is in the kever. The husband predeceased his wife. Then the wife passes away. The wife's property, where does it go? Does it go back to her father or father's family? Or does it go to her husband, who already passed away, and then from the husband down to his relatives? So that's what the Gemara says, that the husband doesn't inherit his wife when he's in the kever. And that'll be exactly like the case of the mother and the son, that the son, who's the oresh, doesn't inherit his mother when he's in the kever, just like the Baal, the husband, doesn't, who's the oresh here, doesn't inherit his wife when he's in the kever. So that's the way the Baal Yatosfot would explain it. Back there in the Gemara on Kuf Yud Dalet, we explained why it was so obvious to the Gemara that the husband doesn't inherit the wife, whereas by the child and the mother, we're not so clear. One of the main answers is the difference in relationship. The relationship between a husband and wife is not a blood relationship. It's a relationship dependent on marriage. And therefore, when there's a dissolution of the marriage, there might be also be a dissolution of that relationship. Whereas when it comes to a mother and a child, that relationship is a blood relationship that should survive death. It has nothing to do with their existence or their marriage. It has to do with the way that they're born. And blood relationships exist even in the kever. So that's why it's obvious to the Gemara that a husband would not inherit his wife bekever, because their marriage is terminated with the death of one of the two parties, depending if you think it's the wife, according to the Rashbam, or the husband, according to the Baal Tosafot. But a mother and a son, that relationship still exists, it still extends, even after the death of the son. But the Hekesh teaches us, just like by the case of the husband, it does not work after the death, so too, by the son, it won't work after the death. And that's the conclusion that we came to in the Gemara over here, that a son does not inherit his mother bekever. All right, now, the Gemara brings another case, again, that doesn't belong over here. It belongs back in the Gemara much earlier in the Masechta, but despite the fact it's brought here, because, again, of its correlation or similarity to our Gemara. As Tosafot notes over here, Mishum da'ari yochi min ha'chasim b'chazkat meihem, because over here we're speaking about who is really the person in Mukhzak in the property. We discussed in the last two Mishnayot, who's considered to be the Mukhzak. Also, it brought these cases over here by the questions of who's considered to be the Mukhzak in these situations. It's a Lokeach, or it is the seller. So even though, again, this Gemara was all brought back on Chavtet Amud Bet and Lamed Amud Aleph earlier in the Masechta, the Gemara brings it back over here because of its correlation or similarity with our Gemara, even though, again, it's not necessary to bring it because it was already previously discussed. I'm selling you the properties of Bar-Sisin. There was one property that was known as the Bay Bar-Sisin. He says, listen, you're right. People call that the property of Bar Sisin, but it wasn't the property of Bar Sisin. So the seller over here says, I'm selling you all property that belonged to Bar Sisin or the household of Bar Sisin. Whatever I acquired from them, I'm selling to you. There's one piece of property that people called Bay Bar Sisin, but the seller says, yes, they do call it that, but it never was his. After the Kamei of Nachman, he came to Rav Nachman to adjudicate the case. Ukmei biyadei lokeach, he gave it to the buyer. Amar lei Rav Rav Nachman, dino hachi? Why would you say this is the case? Amutzimi chaveiro lavaraya. Who's mukzak in the property? The seller is mukzak in the property. The buyer here should have the burden of proof. Why are you giving it to the buyer when the seller is the one who's mukzak in the property? And amutzimi chaveiro lavaraya means that the buyer should have to bring evidence to the fact that this is a property of Bar Sisin and that he can acquire it. Verami derava derava. Verami derav Nachman derav Nachman. So now, Rava, who's a Talmud Muvach of Rav Nachman, is challenging Rav Nachman's psak in this case. The Gemara says that the position staked out here by Rav Nachman and Rova seem to be opposite another case that we have from them. The individual says, "My bait b'hai beita. What are you doing in this house?" Says, "I bought it from you, and I've been here the requisite years of chazakah." Amalei ana b'shchunei gavai havai. I was living in the internal part all along. Again, in cases where the person who supposedly sold it to him still lives in the house, and he says, "I lived in the internal part of the house, and I used to walk through the outer part of the house all along. And that fact that I walked through the outer part of the house was demonstrating or maintaining my ownership over it, and therefore your chazakah is an invalid chazakah, and you should have to bring a shtar. If you don't have a shtar, then that belongs to me, because you don't have any rights to it." So Rav Nachman Pasken Zil Bror Achilatech, Aveidim Shedarta Babayit Levadcha Gimel Shanim. Bring a dim to the fact that you lived there alone for 3 years, and that the other guy wasn't present in the house. Because his statement now undermines your chazakah. So now you have to establish the chazakah. Amalei Rav Rav Nachman Dina Ochi. Is that the right psak here again? The person in possession of the house is the supposed buyer over here, and the seller is the one saying that you don't have a chazakah because I walked through it. Let the seller prove it. The buyer is the one in possession of the property. The seller should have to bring the evidence over here. So kasha d'rava d'rava. So Rava is a stira. In one case he says that the evidence needs to be borne by the buyer, and in the other case now he says that the evidence has to be borne by the seller. And kasha d'rav Nachman d'rav Nachman. Because in one case, Rav Nachman favored the buyer, and in the other case, Rav Nachman favored the seller. So Gemara says, the Rava lo kasha, Rava's positions are not contradictory. Hacha mocher kai b'nichsei, otam lokeach kai b'nichsei. It's very easy. Who's in possession of the property now? In the case of the sale in the first case, the seller's in possession of the property. So the motzi mechaver olavareya, the burden of proof is on the buyer. In our case here, it's the supposed buyer that's in possession of the property. He's lived there supposedly for 3 years, and he's won the property. The seller is the one trying to kick him out. So since he's in the property, the burden of proof is going to be on the seller. So Rav Nachman, other Rav Nachman, lo kasha. Rav Nachman's positions are also not contradicting. Hocha came to Amalei Bei Bar Sisin, umikrei de Bei Bar Sisin, alei de Dei Rami legluye. So since he said, "I'm selling you the properties that belong to Bei Bar Sisin," and sure enough, this property is called Bei Bar Sisin, the burden of proof is going to be on the seller to demonstrate that that's not what he meant. From a superficial perspective here, he said a term, that's the way that that property is called, and everybody knows that. So therefore, that property should have been included in the sale. The fact that he now says that that's the name, but it really wasn't his property, you have the burden of proof to show that, because otherwise, the evidence leads us to believe that it was sold as part of this sale. You got to prove that it's otherwise. Over here, he could just be holding a shtar. Even if the guy showed up with a shtar, he would have to be mekayim the shtar. The other party says you don't really own it. He would be forced to verify his shtar, to validate his shtar. So over here, when he's bringing a chazakah, he has to validate the chazakah. If the questions arise about the chazakah, then you need a validation of the chazakah. Just like if questions arise about a shtar, you need to validate the shtar. So that's the scenario over here. So he doesn't have a shtar. The chazakah is replacing the shtar. So that chazakah has the same din as a shtar. Just like a shtar which there are questions or aspersions cast about the shtar, you have to verify it. So do when the questions arise about your chazakah, you have to prove that the chazakah is valid. And that's why Rav Nachman over here believed that the burden of proof was on the one in the property and not on the one trying to kick him out. Okay, with that we finish Perek Mishemait, Hadron Alach Mishemait.